But first up, we're going to be talking about IQ, and I'm delighted to welcome the show Dr. Emma Rose. Hi, Emma.
Hi, Sean.
Thanks for coming on the show.
No bother.
Okay, so maybe just tell, you're in the Institute of Neuroscience at TCD.
Yes.
Okay, so maybe give us a little bit of background to this project. I know that you were heavily involved in it. You did a lot of the work yourself.
Yeah, so the study that you were actually referring to was actually part of a large international study that we were involved in. It was a project called the Enigma Project. And essentially what that is the largest, what we call, imaging genetics study that's ever been done. And by imaging genetics, we mean studies that include both measures of brain structure, and brain mostly brain structure, combined with genetics information.
Okay. And what is it all of the brain that's linked to this magical IQ or intelligence quotient, or is it kind of specific parts of the brain that you were looking at?
So what the study involved was looking at both the entire brain volume, so the whole brain and the brain space within inside the skull, but also specific structures within the brain, and specifically we were interested in looking at a structure called the hippocampus.
Okay.
Which most commonly we think about the hippocampus as being involved in things like memory.
Okay, and obviously if you've a good memory, that helps with what we call IQ then.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So helping with learning and putting down new information and keeping new information in a kind of long-term store.
Yeah, just to put the study in context then, I think, as I said in the intro, that scientists, they've suspected for a long time that there is this link between IQ and brain size, but it's been hard to kind of nail it down in terms of the genetics.
Yeah, that would be true. I mean, one of the biggest clues that there was perhaps a genetic link to both things is, one, that we see this kind of heritability of brain size. And we also see a strong correlation, for example, in twin pairs with things like IQ. So identical twins tend to have very similar IQ levels.
Right. Now, if that's what happens if you have identical twins that grow up in separate families then, if they're adopted, is what happens with IQ, do you know then?
Again, one of the reasons that we believe that IQ is so strongly related to genetics is even when you have twins who've been reared apart in separate households with separate environments, you still see a strong correlation in the IQs of those twins.
Okay, so that's kind of important, because that suggests that, you know, even if you grow up in a very different environment, let's say one twin grows up in a kind of an educational environment and another one in a not so much so educational environment, their IQs are actually pretty much the same.
Their IQs would be very similar. There's not, though, to say that there's no environmental impact. Does that make sense? So we do tend to see correlations with things like what type of educational resources people have had access to, how long people have stayed in education for. Those kind of things do also correlate with IQ. It's just that these things, like between the twins, they would be highly associated. So you may still see a difference. And what a lot of the work that we do is trying to kind of tease apart what's related to your genetics and what's perhaps related to the things that happen to you in your lifetime, those kind of environmental influences.
Because when I was in college, I think most of the lecturers thought it was a 50-50 type split, genetics and environment, but is that still the case now, or with this particular one, would you say it's more genetics?
It's very hard to say with this particular study. What's interesting and really new about the study is that we've isolated these couple of variants that seem to predict brain size and seem to predict IQ. But what's really important to note is that how much of the IQ variability, or how much IQ differs between individuals, only a very small proportion was accounted for by these two particular genes.
Okay.
So what we call a small effect size.
Okay, so the genes that you found, they're just a small part of the story. There's obviously a lot more genes involved.
Exactly. So, I mean, again, this type of work, why this type of work is really exciting is because it involves all these different sites. We have all these thousands and thousands of subjects that were involved in these studies, and we have all these thousands of brains to look at and genes to look at, that we can start isolating very small changes in the gene that maybe increase or decrease IQ or are related to other types of cognitive functions in people.
Okay. Now, when you say thousands and thousands, that sounds like an awful lot of work. So were you the person that went through the scans then and looked at all of these thousands?
What we had was, so there's a number of different sites involved in this Enigma project all over the world. Almost everybody who does this kind of imaging genetics work was involved. We ourselves looked at about 400 brains, but there was over 20,000 brains were looked at across all the different sites worldwide.
So you guys looked at 400 and then that put in, that was your part of the overall data then?
Exactly. So we looked at 400 brains that were collected here in Ireland, so 400 Irish brains.
Okay. So how did you form the link then between what you saw with, say, somebody with a bigger brain size and these two variants that showed up?
So what happened was there was all of the that we call these genome-wide association study analyses. And so there was an initial analysis that looked at, these two measures, this total brain volume and the volume inside your skull, that intracranial volume, and the hippocampal volume, and isolated these two variants, one which seemed to predict hippocampal volume and one which predicted intracranial volume. And then what happened was, in order to look at what we call these pleiotropic effects or pleiotropic effects.
What does that word mean exactly?
It means having multiple effects.
Okay.
So one of the things was what does it do to the brain size? And then so they had this other sample of subjects, I think it was about 1,600 subjects, that they also had an IQ measure on and the genetics information. And they went back and looked at those individuals to see if this same variant that predicted that total brain space also was associated with IQ.
Okay, and the link then, was it pretty clear between the variants and the larger hippocampus and the larger intracranial size?
Yeah, so the results were pretty clear cut, and there was also, with the hippocampal volume, there was a number of kind of follow-up studies to kind of explore why that particular variant might be involved in hippocampal volume, how it might be involved in brain development, what kind of things the genes might be doing. And a lot of kind of additional evidence from looking at post-mortem brains.
Okay.
And things.
And just an IQ, it mightn't be exactly your area, but where does high IQ start for anybody who's ever done IQ tests, or what do you not have an idea of where?
So what would be a genius level IQ? Is that?
Well, yeah, or a high, say higher than average. It starts with 100 as average, isn't it? Isn't
that 100 would be the average point. As we think about this kind of distribution around that mean, that average value of about 100. We really start to think about kind of genius level IQs as being IQs above 140.
Right.
So quite a bit away from that. But certainly what you'd expect is that most people will kind of cluster around
that. Say the top, where would the top 10% start, kind of thing? You know, what?
Off the top of my head, I really wouldn't know.
Okay, and not to worry. No, just curious, because I'm sure people have done these tests and they'd want to know. But so with brain scanning then, we're just as a general question, I mean, we're finding out so much now, aren't we? Not just about this particular area, about our brains in general. Like, I mean, where are we headed into the future, do you think?
Really where we seem to be going, the type of scanning that we do is a type of scanning called functional MRI. And so it uses the same type of MRI that if you'd hurt your knee or you had some sort of other injury, you might get an MRI scan. But we use it to look at how your brain actually works and how your brain functions when you do certain types of thinking or feeling tasks. And really, as a technology, it's only been around for about the last 20 years. And we spent a lot of time kind of just trying to figure out what brains do in general, so which parts of your brain are involved in certain different functions when you try to remember something, when you pay attention to something. What we're seeing now is kind of what we call more kind of translational work.
What does that mean exactly?
So trying to actually use this type of information to predict illness or to predict treatment outcomes. Certainly within psychiatry and within psychiatric imaging, that's one of the things that we would be interested in, is how do we predict who's going to become unwell, how they're going to become unwell, and how they might respond to treatments. And that's really where we seem to be going, is these kind of much more applied kind of emphasis on imaging.
Yeah, because IQ is one thing, but I mean, it's not life or death really, is it? And, you know, if it was something like mental illness, if you could figure out a way to diagnose somebody before, I suppose, the symptoms start to appear, that'd be pretty useful, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really big area of research. Someone is kind of what we call biomarkers. So you might have slightly different brain function when you perform, again, some sort of thinking or feeling task compared to somebody else. And that, how your brain differs and how it works or how it looks, might be predictive of your chances of getting depression later on or developing something like psychosis.
Okay, but these things aren't set in stone, though, are they? I mean, even if you have, let's say, you have a gene for depression there, I mean, does it guarantee that you're going to get it?
No. And really what we, again, a large part of the work that we do is about kind of delineating risk for psychiatric illness. And I guess how I kind of like to think about it is that you have a number of genetic factors that might influence whether or not you're going to become unwell with mm-hmm. some psychiatric illness. And you either have those risk factors or you don't. And some of them may have a greater risk than others. But you certainly, there's also certainly a large environmental influence. So early life experiences, exposure to drugs and alcohol, stressful life events, a number of things that can happen to you that give you this kind of additive risk and that might predict whether or not you actually become unwell.
Doesn't help, yeah. And can you, for example, can you look at a scan and say if somebody is depressed or not, for example? Is that possible at this point?
That's not what, the stage we're at right now, no. What we tend to do is we look for patterns across groups of individuals. So we would look at a group of individuals who don't have a mental health problem, what we call control subjects, mm-hmm. and then compare those to a group of individuals who either have, again, depression or drug abuse or schizophrenia or something, and then see where we can see overall differences in how the brain might look structurally or how it might be functioning.
Because I'm thinking into the future, you're at the Institute of Neuroscience, but it's linked to psychiatry, isn't it, the Department of Psychiatry there?
Yeah, so Professor Donohoe and myself are within the neuropsychiatric genetics group within the Department of Psychiatry, which is part of that whole kind of umbrella of the Institute of Neuroscience here at Trinity.
Okay, I guess what I'm asking you is that psychiatrists now, they tend to, they'll ask questions and based on the answers they get and their experience, that's really how they determine if somebody's unwell, isn't it, really? So if they had extra information, let's say that into the future, they had a scan of the brain, that might help with their initial diagnosis or possibly.
Again, this is, I mean, where this seems to really be headed is this kind of idea of more personally tailored healthcare and treatment. And so really, you're absolutely right, what we do now, or what psychiatrists would do now, is you kind of have this list of criteria by which you would define someone as having a certain illness. So you tick however many boxes for depression.
Yeah, but they don't always get it 100% right,
exactly.
I suppose.
Exactly. And some of what's probably going on there and why we see these kind of very different presentations in patients might well be related to some of these genetic effects and some of the effects that they have on how the brain looks and how the brain works. And so if we can get more specific information about how or why somebody is ill or how they might respond to specific treatments, that's kind of where this thing seems to be going, again, kind of making it more personally tailored. And hopefully the overall aim is to improve outcome for individuals.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the long term.
Yeah, and just a final question then on the your team there in Trinity that you're part of. What's next then after this particular one where you've found this interesting link with IQ, two genes? I mean, what's the next project that you have lined up or that you're working on?
Well, there's a number of other interesting projects coming out of the Enigma project that this is all part of. One of the next things that the consortium is hoping to do is not only look at this overall brain structure, but look at some of the connections in the brain. So using a type of imaging called diffusion imaging, looking at how the kind of wiring inside the brain might be influenced by, again, either these genes or some other gene variants. As a group, a large part of what we do is kind of looking at specific genetic risks for psychosis. Mm-hmm. And looking at how those impact upon brain structure and brain function. So that's really where our work seems to be lying right now.
Okay, it sounds very interesting, I must say. And thanks very much for taking time out to come and talk to us here on the show.
No bother at all, Sean. Okay. Thanks.
That's Dr. Emma Rose. She's based at Trinity College in Dublin, part of this big Enigma study. It's an international study. One thing that's come out of it there recently, just Trinity has found that there's two genes. They're not the only genes, but two genes that seem to be linked to IQ and brain size. So that's very interesting, and we'll follow that with interest.